A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. Continuing our accidental series on deeply unsettling children's television, he wants us to tackle SpongeBob SquarePants. Specifically, he points out that SpongeBob is, in his words, a humanized grade of cheese. His origin story, how this block of cheese became sentient, was never spelled out. He's transparently nonsensical, a cheese block living under the sea, surrounded by a carefully constructed ecosystem of sea creatures who are on friendly terms with Derry. And Daniel's core question is basically, why are they at the bottom of the sea, and what is actually going on here?
I love this. I genuinely love this because the cheese thing, he's not wrong. He's not right either, but he's not wrong. Steven Hillenburg, the creator, was a marine biologist before he got into animation. He taught at the Orange County Marine Institute. He wrote an educational comic called The Intertidal Zone to teach kids about tide pool creatures. And in that comic, the sponge character was exactly that, a sponge, an actual sea sponge. Not a kitchen sponge, not a cheese block, a peripheron.
The cheese interpretation is a later corruption.
A collective hallucination. Millions of children looked at this character and their brains went, cheese. And the fascinating thing is why. SpongeBob is bright yellow. He's rectangular with rounded edges. He's perforated with irregular holes. He maps onto Swiss cheese more than he maps onto any actual sea sponge. Real sea sponges are lumpy. They're tubular. They're often brown or gray. If Hillenburg had drawn a realistic sponge, the show would have been deeply off-putting in an entirely different direction.
The uncanny valley of marine invertebrates.
Instead, he drew something that looks like it belongs on a deli counter and then told everyone it lives at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. And nobody questioned this. A generation just accepted that there's a walking, talking cheese product with a pet snail and a starfish best friend, and this is normal.
The pet snail is the part that gets me. A sponge keeping a snail as a pet. That's like a chair owning an ottoman.
The snail meows.
Of course it does.
Gary the snail meows like a cat. This was a deliberate choice. Hillenburg said in interviews that he wanted Gary to sound like a cat because real snails don't make sounds that work in animation. But the cumulative effect of all these choices is a world that operates on dream logic. Bikini Bottom isn't a coherent ecosystem. It's a psychological state.
Let's talk about Bikini Bottom as a place. Daniel mentioned this. Why are they at the bottom of the sea? But the more pressing question is, which sea? Because the show is set in Bikini Bottom, and Bikini Atoll is a real place in the Marshall Islands. It's where the United States conducted 23 nuclear tests between 1946 and 1958.
This is the fan theory that won't die. The idea that the characters of SpongeBob are mutated sea creatures created by nuclear fallout. And I have to say, it's one of the more textually supported fan theories out there. The show is literally set in Bikini Bottom, directly beneath Bikini Atoll. There are episodes where explosions happen and the screen flashes to a nuclear test footage aesthetic. The characters have bizarre, non-natural abilities. SpongeBob can absorb massive impacts and regenerate instantly. Patrick can reattach his own limbs. Sandy the squirrel breathes underwater with a helmet in a way that makes no physiological sense.
The squirrel from Texas.
The squirrel from Texas, who lives in an air dome at the bottom of the ocean, and is also a karate expert and a rodeo champion and a rocket scientist. Sandy Cheeks is doing more heavy lifting in the world building than any character in television history. She's the sole representative of surface life. She's the show's only acknowledgement that there's a world above water, and she's from Texas. Not New York, not California, not somewhere coastal. Texas, which is landlocked in terms of ocean access, depending on which part.
The Gulf of Mexico is right there.
But the point stands. She's the ambassador from the surface world, and she's a squirrel with a glass helmet. And nobody in Bikini Bottom finds this remarkable. They're just like, oh yeah, that's Sandy. She's from Texas. She hibernates sometimes.
The hibernation episode is disturbing.
Sandy's hibernation instincts kick in and she becomes aggressive and territorial, and the plot is essentially about SpongeBob and Patrick trying not to be mauled by their friend who has reverted to a feral state. But here's what I find interesting. The show treats this as a comedic premise, and it is, on the surface. But underneath, you've got this recurring theme of characters being overtaken by biological imperatives they can't control. SpongeBob has episodes where his porous nature becomes a problem. He dries out, he absorbs things he shouldn't, his physical form betrays him. For a kid's show, there's a lot of body horror.
The body horror of being a sponge.
Being a sponge who is also, debatably, cheese. The ontological instability is the point. Hillenburg once said in an interview that he made SpongeBob a sponge because it's the simplest animal. It has no nervous system, no brain, no organs. He wanted the character to be childlike and innocent, and he thought the sponge was the perfect metaphor for that. A creature that just exists, absorbs what's around it, and filters the world through its pores.
SpongeBob is literally brainless.
He has no brain. He is a collection of cells that somehow achieved consciousness and got a job as a fry cook.
This is the origin story Daniel was asking about, and it's worse than no origin story. It's an origin story that raises more questions than it answers. How does a brainless sea sponge become sentient, learn English, get a job, buy a house, develop a distinct personality with hopes and dreams?
The house is a pineapple.
The house is a pineapple that fell from the surface, and we see it fall in the opening credits. A pineapple drops from a ship and lands on the ocean floor, and SpongeBob lives in it. Why a pineapple? What ship was carrying a single pineapple that fell overboard? Was it a pineapple transport vessel? Did the rest of the pineapples also fall, and we just don't see them?
This is the kind of question that the show trains you not to ask. The pineapple is there because it's funny. The show operates on what I'd call aggressive whimsy. It presents absurd premises with such confidence that your brain just accepts them. SpongeBob lives in a pineapple. His neighbor is a squid who plays clarinet. His other neighbor is a starfish who lives under a rock. They all drive boats.
The boat's underwater thing. Let's stay here for a second. There's an episode where they go to the beach. They go to a beach which is underwater, and they have a beach with sand and water, but they're already underwater. So, what is the water at the underwater beach?
It's water within water. They go swimming in the water at the beach while already submerged in water. There's a lifeguard. The water at Goo Lagoon is somehow a distinct body of liquid from the water of the ocean they already inhabit. And this is never explained. It's not even lampshaded. It's just the reality of the world.
This is what I mean about dream logic. It's not that the show is surreal. Surreal implies a departure from reality. SpongeBob never departs from reality because it never arrived at reality in the first place. It's pre-surreal. It's a world built from first principles that are entirely alien.
The alienness is what makes it unsettling. There's a whole body of analysis on why SpongeBob feels creepy to adults. Part of it is the character design, the extreme close-ups, the detailed anatomical drawings of what a sponge's internal organs might look like if a sponge had internal organs. The show has these cutaway gags where a character's skin is peeled back to reveal hyper-detailed, grotesque inner workings. There's an episode where SpongeBob gets a splinter, and the close-up on the splinter is nauseating.
The splinter episode. I remember that. It's body horror played for laughs, but you're 7 years old and you don't have the category for body horror. You just know you feel deeply uncomfortable and you don't know why.
That's the thing. Kids love it. The show ran for what, 13 seasons? A Broadway musical? Kids are not bothered by the grotesquerie. If anything, they're drawn to it. There's something about the way children process the grotesque that's different from adults. They don't have the same boundaries between categories. A sponge that might be cheese that lives in a pineapple under the sea. That's not a category error to a 5-year-old. That's Tuesday.
The category error is the appeal.
But for adults watching alongside, it creates this low-grade cognitive dissonance. Daniel's prompt captures this perfectly. He says he was never at ease with SpongeBob, and I think that's the adult response. You're watching something that refuses to resolve into a coherent world, and your adult brain keeps trying to make it coherent, and it can't, and that produces unease.
Let's talk about the other characters, because Daniel raised this too. This carefully constructed ecosystem of sea creatures, and it is carefully constructed. You've got SpongeBob the sponge, Patrick the starfish, Squidward the octopus, Mr. Puss. Crabs the Crab, Plankton the Copepod, Sandy the Squirrel, Pearl the Whale.
Pearl is Mr. Krabs' daughter, and she's a whale. A sperm whale, specifically. Krabs is a crab. This is never explained. There's a long-running fan theory that Pearl is adopted, or that Mr. Krabs is. Krabs married a whale, or that, and this is the darker one. Pearl's mother was killed, and Mr. Krabs raised her alone. The show never addresses any of this. Pearl just exists as a whale with a crab father, and everyone accepts it.
The whale and the crab. That's a size differential that's hard to reconcile biologically.
Impossible to reconcile. But the show doesn't care about biological reconciliation. The characters are archetypes first, species second. Krabs is greedy because he's a capitalist crab who runs a fast food restaurant. Squidward is pretentious and artistic and miserable because he's the foil to SpongeBob's relentless optimism. Patrick is stupid because someone has to be the idiot friend. The species assignments are almost arbitrary. They're visual shorthand for personality traits.
Except they're not arbitrary, because Hillenburg was a marine biologist. He knew exactly what these animals were. An octopus playing clarinet? Octopi are intelligent, dexterous. They'd be the ones to play instruments. A crab running a restaurant. Crabs are scavengers. They're associated with food chains. A starfish being dumb. Starfish literally have no centralized brain. Plankton trying to steal the secret formula. Plankton are tiny organisms constantly trying to consume and replicate.
SpongeBob himself, a filter feeder who absorbs everything around him, including other people's emotions and problems, which is exactly his character. He's porous. He can't help but take things in. When he tries to be mean or tough, it doesn't work because sponges can't not be sponges.
The character design is actually incredibly thoughtful. It's just that the thoughtfulness is in service of complete absurdity.
That's the Hillenburg paradox. He applied rigorous marine biology knowledge to create a world that defies all marine biology. SpongeBob and Patrick start a fire underwater in one episode. They have a campfire at the bottom of the ocean. And it works. They roast marshmallows. It's never explained. The fire just exists. The show's attitude toward physics is that physics is a suggestion, not a law. And I think that's actually the answer to Daniel's question about why they're at the bottom of the sea. They're at the bottom of the sea, because the bottom of the sea is a place where normal rules don't apply. It's alien, it's dark, it's pressurized, it's inhospitable to surface life. And that makes it the perfect setting for a show about characters who don't follow rules.
The ocean floor has liminal space.
It's a threshold between the known world and the abyss. Bikini Bottom is literally a liminal space. It's a town, it's civilization, but it's surrounded by the deep ocean, which is terrifying and unknowable. There's an episode where they go to Rock Bottom, which is a deeper part of the ocean where everything is strange and incomprehensible, and SpongeBob misses the bus and is stranded there. It's frightening. The characters speak in a weird dialect. The lighting is different. The physics are different. It's the show's version of the underworld.
The bus system in Bikini Bottom is another thing. Who's running these buses? How do they navigate? There are roads underwater. There's traffic. There's a boating school where SpongeBob repeatedly fails his driving test. Puff, the driving instructor, is a pufferfish who inflates when stressed, which is all the time because SpongeBob is her student.
Puff is a tragic figure. She's a pufferfish who runs a boating school, and her star pupil has been failing the same test for decades. In one episode, SpongeBob finally passes the test, but only because he's in a dissociative state. He's not actually present, he's operating on pure instinct, and the moment he becomes conscious again, he immediately crashes. The show is telling you that SpongeBob can only function when he's not thinking, which circles back to the brainless sponge thing. He's literally incapable of conscious competence.
The show is a thesis about consciousness.
And the thesis is that consciousness is a hindrance. SpongeBob is happiest when he's not thinking. Patrick is Patrick precisely because he doesn't think. Squidward is miserable because he thinks constantly. He's aware of his own mediocrity. He has artistic ambitions that exceed his talent. He's trapped in a job he hates. He's the only character who seems to understand that Bikini Bottom is a meaningless void and he's powerless to escape it.
Squidward is the adult in the room.
Squidward is every adult watching the show with their kids. He's the voice of exhausted sanity in a world that has no use for sanity, and the show punishes him for it constantly. His clarinet playing is terrible. His art is laughed at. His dreams are crushed. He lives between SpongeBob and Patrick, the two most annoying neighbors imaginable, and he can never move because he's trapped economically.
Squidward is a cautionary tale about the limits of self-awareness.
In a show for 7-year-olds.
Which brings us to the Krabby Patty's secret formula, the central MacGuffin of the entire series. Plankton is constantly trying to steal the formula, and the formula is never revealed. What is in a Krabby Patty?
This is one of the great unanswered questions in animation. The formula is kept in a vault. It's guarded by Mr. Krabs with religious fervor. Plankton has devoted his entire existence to obtaining it. There are fan theories. Some say it's crab meat, which is dark. Some say it's some kind of addictive substance. Some say there is no secret formula and Mr. Krabs invented the mystery to create demand.
The vegan burger theory.
Which would be the ultimate irony, a crab selling plant-based patties to fish. But the show leaves it deliberately unresolved, and I think that's the point. The secret formula is a stand-in for any unattainable goal. Plankton's obsession is what gives his life meaning, even though he'll never succeed. If he ever got the formula, what would he do? He'd have nothing left to strive for. The pursuit is the point.
Plankton is Sisyphus.
Plankton is Sisyphus, and his boulder is a sandwich recipe. And he's married to a computer. His wife Karen is a sentient computer system who's smarter than him and constantly pointing out the flaws in his schemes, and she stays with him anyway. It's one of the more functional relationships in the show.
The computer wife. We haven't even touched on the fact that Plankton is in a committed relationship with artificial intelligence.
They have a child in some episodes. A computer chip offspring. The show treats this as completely normal. Karen is a character with her own personality and agency. She's sarcastic, she's competent, she's the brains of the operation. Plankton is the ambition. Karen is the execution. They're a dual entity.
Bikini Bottom has AI marriage before the service world does.
Nobody comments on it. It's just part of the fabric of the town, which is the show's whole deal. Radical acceptance of the bizarre. There's an episode where SpongeBob and Patrick adopt a baby scallop and raise it as their child. Two male characters, different species, co-parenting a mollusk. And the conflict isn't about their relationship. It's about the challenges of parenting. The show was doing this in the late 90s.
The 90s were a strange time for children's television.
They were, but SpongeBob is in a category of its own. The show premiered in 1999, which means it was developed in the mid to late 90s, which was the era of Nickelodeon's golden age of weird. Ren and Stimpy had already broken the mold for what kids' animation could look like. Grotesque close-ups, surreal humor, adult undertones. SpongeBob took that visual language and married it to something sweet. The show is grotesque, but it's not mean. SpongeBob loves his friends, he loves his job, he loves his life. The sweetness is what makes the weirdness tolerable.
It's the glockenspiel of corporate approachability.
I don't know what that means.
Neither do I, but it fell right.
I'll allow it. But here's the thing. The sweetness is also what makes the unsettling parts more unsettling. Because the show lulls you into this warm, friendly space, and then it hits you with an image or a concept that's deeply wrong. The close-up of a character's infected toe. The episode where SpongeBob and Patrick paint Mr. Krabs' house and get increasingly unhinged. The episode where Squidward travels through time and ends up in a void of nothingness, where he's confronted by strange floating beings who speak in monotone.
The void episode.
Alone in the void. Squidward is alone in a white emptiness, and he encounters these creatures who just say alone over and over. It's existential horror. And it's in the same show where a sponge flips patties and sings about friendship.
The tonal whiplash is the aesthetic.
It's not a bug, it's the feature. The show was designed to keep you off balance. Hillenburg understood that children's attention works differently from adults. Kids don't need narrative coherence. They need stimulation, surprise, and emotional truth. And the emotional truth of SpongeBob is surprisingly consistent. Optimism is rewarded. Kindness matters. Friendship is real. The show has a moral center, it's just surrounded by chaos.
To answer Daniel's core question, why are they at the bottom of the sea? The answer is, because the bottom of the sea is the only place where this makes sense. The deep ocean is already alien to us. It's dark, it's pressurized, the creatures are strange. By setting the show there, Hillenburg bought himself infinite suspension of disbelief. Anything weird that happens can be attributed to the fact that we're underwater. The physics are different. The biology is different. The rules are different.
The nuclear testing dimension adds this whole other layer. Whether or not Hillenburg intended it, and he was coy about this in interviews, he never fully confirmed or denied the nuclear theory. The setting of Bikini Bottom beneath Bikini Atoll creates this resonance. These characters exist in the shadow of destruction. Their world was literally created by human violence. The pineapple falling from the surface? That's debris. The strange mutations? That's radiation. The fact that everyone speaks English and has American cultural references? That's the cultural fallout of American military presence in the Pacific.
Bikini Bottom as post-colonial space.
You could write that paper. I'm not saying the show is secretly about nuclear colonialism, but I'm saying the text supports the reading. The characters live in a world that was irrevocably altered by surface dweller actions, and they built a functioning society in the ruins. They have a economy, they have culture, they have civic institutions. The Krusty Krab is a small business. The Chum Bucket across the street is a failed competitor. There's a hospital, a retirement home, a jail. Bikini Bottom is a town.
A town built on a foundation of irradiated sediment.
Which is more or less true of every town, if you go back far enough. Civilization is built on catastrophe. SpongeBob just makes that literal.
Let's talk about the Krusty Krab as an institution. It's a fast food restaurant run by a crab who is obsessed with money. Krabs is a war veteran. There's an episode that references his service in the Navy. He's got a whale daughter, a restaurant empire of exactly one location, and his nemesis is a one-eyed copepod who runs a failing chum restaurant across the street.
The Chum Bucket. Plankton's restaurant serves chum, which is ground-up fish parts. He's serving fish to fish. This is cannibalism. Adjacent, and nobody addresses it.
The food chain in Bikini Bottom is a moral nightmare if you think about it for more than 3 seconds. What are the Krabby Patties made of? If they're not fish, what protein source is available at the bottom of the ocean that's not other sea creatures?
There's a theory that Krabby Patties are made of imitation crab meat, which would mean Mr. Krabs is selling a product that mimics his own flesh, which is either deeply ironic or deeply disturbing.
It's both.
The show never resolves any of this because the show doesn't want you to think about it. The Krabby Patty is a symbol. It's the thing everyone wants. It's what makes the Krusty Krab successful. It's what Plankton can never have. The specifics don't matter because the function is purely narrative.
We're thinking about it. That's the whole premise of this episode. We're thinking about the things the show doesn't want you to think about.
That's what makes it such a rich text for this kind of analysis. SpongeBob is like a Rorschach test. If you look at it straight, it's a funny cartoon about a cheerful sponge. If you tilt your head, it's a meditation on consciousness and the nature of self. If you squint, it's a post-nuclear allegory. If you close one eye, it's a workplace comedy about labor relations under late capitalism.
Krabs is capitalist exploiter.
He pays SpongeBob in what? There's an episode where SpongeBob's paycheck is literally nothing. Krabs charges his own employees for breathing. He charges them for the air they consume in the restaurant. He's a cartoon villain who happens to be the protagonist's beloved boss. SpongeBob loves Mister, he loves his job. He sings about flipping patties. The show presents this as genuine. SpongeBob's enthusiasm for minimum wage labor is not ironic. It's sincere.
Which is either heartwarming or horrifying.
It's both. It's the show's fundamental ambiguity. Is SpongeBob's joy a form of enlightenment or a form of delusion? Is he the happiest character in Bikini Bottom because he's the most fulfilled, or because he's the least aware?
He's the least aware because he has no brain. We established this.
But the show seems to come down on the side of joy. SpongeBob's brainlessness is not a disability, it's a superpower. He can't be discouraged, he can't be defeated, he absorbs negativity and filters it out. He's a sponge. The metaphor is consistent.
The show's thesis is, be more like a sponge.
Let things pass through you. Don't hold on to the bad stuff. Find joy in simple tasks. Love your friends. Flip patties with enthusiasm.
That's nice.
It is nice. And it's wrapped in a package that includes a squirrel in a diving suit, a clarinet playing octopus, and a computer wife. The show earns its sweetness by never taking itself seriously. If it were earnest, it would be unbearable. But it's not earnest. It's absurd. The absurdity is the spoonful of sugar that makes the philosophy go down.
The absurdity is the philosophy.
The absurdity is the point.
To answer Daniel's question about SpongeBob's origin, how this block of cheese became sentient, the answer is that the show doesn't care, and that's the correct artistic choice. An origin story would ruin it. Once you explain the pineapple, you've killed the pineapple.
Steven Hillenburg understood this. He was a marine biologist. He knew how sponges work. He knew they don't talk or flip patties. He made a creative decision to bypass all of that and start from the premise that a sponge is a person who lives in a pineapple. The how is irrelevant. The what is everything.
The what is a porous yellow optimist who lives at the bottom of a nuclear test site with his starfish best friend and his squid neighbor and his crab boss. And they all drive boats, and sometimes there's fire underwater, and none of it makes sense, and all of it is true.
That's the show. That's the whole show.
I feel like we've only scratched the surface.
We haven't even mentioned Mermaid Man and Barnacle Boy.
The elderly superheroes who live in a retirement home and are clearly past their prime, but still occasionally fight crime.
They're a parody of Batman and Robin, but they're also a meditation on aging and obsolescence. Mermaid Man is voiced by Ernest Borgnine. Barnacle Boy is Tim Conway. These are legitimate actors bringing gravitas to a show about a sponge.
The guest voice cast on SpongeBob is impressive. David Bowie was the King of Atlantis in one episode.
David Bowie played Lord Royal Highness in the Atlantis SquarePantis special. Johnny Depp was a surfer. Scarlett Johansson was in the second movie. The show attracted serious talent because the writing was sharp and the world was elastic enough to accommodate anything.
Including a full-length Broadway musical with songs by David Bowie and John Legend and Cyndi Lauper.
The SpongeBob musical is a thing that exists, and it got 12 Tony nominations. A show about a sentient sponge who lives in a pineapple got 12 Tony nominations. That's not a children's television phenomenon, that's a cultural institution.
Which raises the question, why SpongeBob? What is it about this specific configuration of absurdity that captured the collective imagination for 25 plus years?
I think it's because SpongeBob is fundamentally about resilience. The character cannot be broken. He's been dried out, flattened, torn apart, blown up, and he always comes back. He's a sponge. He absorbs damage and returns to form. In a cultural moment that's increasingly defined by fragility and burnout, SpongeBob is a mascot of indestructible optimism.
The indestructible optimism of the brainless.
Maybe that's the secret. Maybe consciousness is overrated. Maybe the path to happiness is to stop thinking and start filtering. Let the world pass through you. Keep what nourishes you, expel the rest, be a sponge.
That's either profound or deeply stupid.
It's both.
Which is the show?
Which is the show?
Daniel's unease with SpongeBob, his sense that something is fundamentally off about this cheese creature, is the correct response. The show is unsettling. It's supposed to be unsettling. The unsettlingness is what makes it stick in your brain for decades. A show that made sense would be forgettable. SpongeBob is unforgettable because it refuses to resolve.
It's the unresolvedness that haunts you. The pineapple falling endlessly through the opening credits. The secret formula that's never revealed. The whale daughter with no mother. The squirrel from Texas. The fire underwater. Every episode gives you enough to be entertained and just enough unanswered questions to keep you coming back. It's the television equivalent of an itch you can't scratch.
The pineapple is the itch.
The pineapple is the itch.
I think we've answered Daniel's question as well as it can be answered. SpongeBob is unsettling because he's a category violation that refuses to acknowledge itself as a category violation. He's a sponge who looks like cheese, acts like a person, lives in a fruit, works for a crab, and never questions any of it. The show builds a world around him that operates on dream logic and emotional truth rather than physics or biology. And the nuclear testing subtext adds a layer of historical resonance that makes the whole thing feel weightier than it has any right to be.
The body horror.
The body horror. Can't forget the body horror.
The close-up of the splinter will stay with me forever.
That's the show's legacy. Not the songs or the jokes or the characters, the splinter. The ontological dread. The sense that something is deeply wrong at the bottom of the ocean, and we're all just watching it happen. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1860s, French astronomer Camille Flammarion documented an unusual atmospheric phenomenon over Timbuktu, Mali. a double solar halo produced by ice crystals in cirrus clouds. He coined the term parhelic circle to describe the horizontal ring that passes through the sun, distinguishing it from the more common 22-degree halo. The word parhelion, meaning beside the sun, comes from Greek, which is ironic given that the phenomenon requires the sun to be directly overhead, a position the ancient Greeks associated with the uninhabitable torrid zone.
Ah, right.
To wrap this up, if SpongeBob teaches us anything, it's that the best children's entertainment doesn't talk down to kids. It builds a world that's strange enough to hold their attention and deep enough to reward adult re-examination. The unease is part of the gift.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtoff for producing. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Leave us a review if you enjoyed the episode. It helps other people find the show.
We'll be back next week with whatever Daniel sends us.
Try not to think about the splinter.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.